Welcome to the January 20th, 2026 regular session of the Island County Board of Health. You have before you an agenda. Is there a motion to approve the agenda as presented, or are there any changes?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and second to approve the agenda as presented. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And any changes to the regular session minutes from December 16th? If not, a motion to approve minutes.
Motion to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, excellent. This is the time in our board meeting we set aside for public input and comments. We value your input. The time is set aside on subjects of a health-related nature, not on the regular scheduled agenda. All information is taken under advisement unless emergent in nature, no action is taken. If there is anyone here in the room for public input, please raise your hands. Seeing none, we'll turn to our online participants. And if you could raise your hand or somehow indicate that you're here for public input. Again, call for public input. Seeing none, we will close our public input and begin our regular agenda. Yes, chair's discretion, we're going to allow Mr. Gelder to Golder
Right.
to introduce a new public hospital commission member.
Yeah, I'd like to introduce Dr. Gasper. He is our new commissioner at the hospital. Would you like to introduce yourself and say a few minute say a few words, please?
Sure, don't have much to say, but yes, I'm
You
Dr.
can't
Gasper.
say it from there. You're going to have to come to a mic.
I am Dr. Kirk Gasper. I'm one of the newly elected.
Dr. Kirk Gasper, excuse me, one of the newly elected commissioners at the hospital. I appreciate the opportunity to attend and watch your business here. Prior history of as a family physician for 20 plus years with the Navy, retired in 2017. So, and otherwise, just again, first meeting here attending, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Welcome. All right, Sean, go ahead with the proclamation then.
Good afternoon, board members. Public Health Director Sean Morris. So today we're bringing forward a resolution to name January 23rd, 2026 as Maternal Health Awareness Day in Island County. This is resolution number HD-01-26 up on the screen and in your packet. So in Island County, of course, the health of children and families is a top priority, and we know that investing in families protects our community's shared future. I'll read through the draft resolution once, all the way through, and then open it up for board questions.
Sean, I might suggest you pull it a little closer just because even to me, you're quiet.
Thank you. Okay, so I'll go through the whereas statements. So, whereas Island County recognizes that the health and well-being of our children and families are the highest priority of our local government, serving as the foundational bedrock of a thriving, resilient community. And whereas maternal health represents a critical continuum of care that begins before pregnancy and extends through the postpartum period, impacting the long-term physical and emotional health of both the parent and the child. And whereas Island County is committed to investing in the health of our families to support the vitality of our shared future, ensuring every child can reach their full potential. And whereas our dedicated county staff provide essential support through nursing care for new families, parent and family support, behavioral health outreach, and the Women, Infants, and Children WIC program, ensuring no family walks their journey alone. Sure I don't miss one. Okay. Whereas we are fortunate to have a strong network of local providers, including our local hospital and pediatricians, who provide essential medical care to safeguard the health of our residents. And whereas the service of early childhood support organizations, school and childhood professionals, and the Help Me Grow Care Directory provides a vital safety net, connecting families with the resources they need to give their children the best possible start in life. Now, therefore, be it proclaimed that the Island County Board of Health hereby designates January 23rd, 2026 as Maternal Health Awareness Day in Island County. Be it further proclaimed that the board honors the work of our public health nurses, community health workers, WIC team, human services professionals, and behavioral health specialists who provide the compassionate care necessary for families to thrive, recognizes the critical role of our local medical community, community-based organizations and hospital district, and providing essential care and services, encourages all residents to support local families. Cut off again. Encourages all residents to support local families, acknowledging that it takes a dedicated community to raise healthy children and build a healthy future. So I'll pause and turn it back over to the board for any questions or adjustments.
Any thoughts, questions?
I have one. Go ahead. So just curious, Dr. Morris, so the Board of Island County Commissioners has, there's at least one resolution that we pass every year, not in public health. But there's at least one resolution we pass every year because besides the fact that we support the issue, it also grant dollars are tied to our passing a resolution. I'm just checking with you to see if there's any financial implications, pro or con, to us passing this.
This one is, budget neutral. It recognizes the grant-funded services we provide and emphasizes them. We will have an FPHS-focused resolution that we'll bring before the board in February that is more directly tied to sustainable grant funding.
Okay, thank you.
No, I reviewed this, and my apologies, and in no way to demean this, but the first sentence, it jumped out at me that we don't stack rank priority populations. We have priorities. So I might suggest a minor edit that whereas Island County recognizes the health and well-being of our children and families are a high priority of local government. I don't want seniors or our veterans or other populations to feel like they're lesser. They're all important to us and we hold them equally and create space for that.
I think that's important. We'll make that correction.
Any other thoughts? If not, do I have a motion to adopt this resolution recognizing January 23rd, 2026 as Maternal Health Awareness Day in Island County?
So moved. Second.
I only have one comment.
Sure.
With the motion in front of us, and that is I've long, as an early childhood specialist, said it's not maternal child family health only, it's paternal and maternal. And I just sometimes feel like the role that fathers play in healthy families sometimes gets minimized. And I want to emphasize that with this, we're really talking about the health of our families, whether they're led by a mother and a father, or whether they're any composite single family, single parent families, we are just really affirming families. The language here, when I reread it, left me with that unintentional bias in it. And I just wanted to state that.
Thank you.
All in favor of this motion?
Aye.
Any opposed? It passes. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
When we promote it, could you emphasize that this is really about all families?
Yeah, we will. We will. And there's a draft press release in the packet, so we'll integrate that language. Really important. And we have a social media post in there as well, so we'll get those updated and share this out.
Okay. And you have a second action item, I believe.
Yes. So legislative priorities. The 2026 legislative session is officially in its second week. It convened on January 12th, and it's a very active session. It's a short session. The first week itself was very active with committee hearings focused on different core priorities for the Board of Health, the public health workforce, environmental health, foundational public health services. So today in the packet, there's a bill status and prioritization report that helps us ensure our department can respond quickly and provide feedback on legislative items during this fast moving session. So there is a proposed motion where the board would allow staff to follow up on the positions in the table below. And I'll highlight a few of those that are maybe of higher importance. Number one, House Bill 2242 is around preventive services. And really it's about ensuring we have ongoing access to science-based public health guidance and essential vaccines for children and adults, and that insurance covers those vaccines. We know vaccination is the cornerstone of prevention. And so the state is developing this approach to just keep that access available to all of our communities and keep that insurance coverage intact. And there is a companion Senate bill that are both moving through committees currently. Wasalfo is strongly supportive and testified in support. I'd also call attention to House Bill 2145 around the 340B medication access program. This is a high priority for us. The 340B drug pricing program supports our access to tuberculosis medications and medications for expedited partner therapy services that we provide. So critical access to important antibiotics and other medications. And then additionally, there are bills related to environmental planning, aquifer recharge, Senate Bill 6016, House Bill 2201. There's more information in the packet. Those are primarily the bills I wanted to highlight. There are quite a few more in the packet that we can review progress on at the next meeting, but I wanted to get this report to you considering we're in week two. So again, the ask is if there is support for staff to follow through and we could provide this feedback as these bills move through as staff representing the board's position. There is one change, Senate Bill 5990. There's a note of support here. To stay in alignment with Wasalfo, this is around rural health officer qualifications. The recommendation is to pause this item for the time being and bring stakeholders together for additional conversation. So that actually, to note, would be more of a pause than support advancement.
So these are recommendations from Wasalfo?
Yes.
Any questions before I ask mine?
No.
I'm going to start my first question with 340B. The 340B program is a federal program that provides drug pricing. And I know that last year when we met with Senator Murray in Oak Harbor, human service providers and others, that issue came up. And it came up in as well when I was talking with some folks over at Whidbey Health, because your pharmacy takes advantage of the 340B pricing. What's the difference between this bill as a state function and the 340B federal program that's also a little threatened?
So the 340B, my understanding is that this would prevent manufacturer limitations on the drug pricing program. I believe our state program is the implementation of that federal program, but I'll confirm that and follow up with the board.
Regardless, I'm strongly supportive of protecting that 340B. It makes everything from frequently utilized drugs to specialty drugs, and you talked about the TB, affordable. It could have a very negative impact both on the consumer and on hospital pricing. So if you could just get back with some more detail on that, I'd appreciate it. On the Senate Bill 5990, my suggestion is take out support and put monitoring and leave it there. I know we're appreciative of Senator Mazzal's efforts on this, but I know they're trying to work out some of the differences. So perhaps we could just change the category to monitoring. And the heat response plans, I always have concerns when I look at the legislature mandating things that local government should be doing without consulting with local government. So
yeah, some more conversation could be helpful there. The heat response, I mean, it's important work and work we engage yeah. in, but to see what that looks like and if we want to avoid the unfunded mandates.
Right. Anytime I see words that say would create a new mandate for counties, I get a little concerned about what that might mean.
Yeah.
This is a little new. We don't normally endorse a legislative platform. So I just wonder what the board thinks about that.
Right.
We usually get informed on it.
Yeah. Back on 340B. As you know, a lot of the pharmacies nationwide have struggled to keep open, and a lot of them have closed. We operate on some very, very thin margins, and sometimes we end up passing out drugs that actually cost us more than what we collect on them. The 340B program allows us to pay a little bit of a discounted price on some of our drugs, and we do operate on a very thin margin. So basically, you might say that might be the difference that keeps our pharmacies open. So yes, it's very, very important that we work to try and get this type of legislation through, because it's going to be beneficial for the entire community.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner.
With regard to, so your question, Janet, if I have it correctly, is whether or not we want to give them authority to call in and say Island County Board of Health supports this or is opposed to this.
Yes.
I like that idea. I was really fascinated when I did testimony last week, and you know, all of the bills, they say how many people were called in support and how many people called in opposition. And I would like to feel that our Board of Health has some say in that as well, participates in that.
And we could keep it to simply signing in to the bill on behalf of the Board of Health. And then if there's written testimony to provide, that could come before the board, if that makes sense.
I actually trust you as staff to have articulate and concise language and support, because I think that's important to say the why.
Okay.
But, you know, I certainly... you know, of these, the Preventative Health Services Bill and 340B are probably my top two priorities, but the local food security and protecting our food banks at a time when not only was there cuts to SNAP, we have increased demand, the federal government cut the federal access that food banks had to for pricing, similar to our other issue. And so, you know, nutrition is a foundation of good health as well. So there's several of here that seem to have a federal nexus, but I think if our state can shore up and protect our residents, I'm certainly supportive of that.
Sure.
Any other thoughts or comments? If you are in support of that, if you'd like to make a motion to accept the proposed ratification of the early session testimony and delegate to Sean. And if anything, I think if anything is added, we didn't add anything in behavioral health, but we can do that at a future meeting to speak on behalf of it, with the one change of moving a Senate Bill 5990 to monitoring, since Wasalfa is really working on that bill.
Yeah.
I move approval of the authorization to ratify early session testimony and delegate staff authority to sign on in priority bills for the remainder of the leg session.
Second.
So a motion and second to approve ratification of this test, this
early testimony.
Thank you. I lost my brain for a moment. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. We have Taylor, a new or a reappointment, right, for our Community Health Advisory Board. So just a moment, since we have some new folks in the room. Our Community Health Advisory Board is a volunteer board that has been in existence for many years. Island County was one of the first counties, I think, to actually initiate a citizen or community advisory board. And I actually, my first encounter with Island County and Celine in the back there was as a member of the Community Health Advisory Board. So that board is critical to providing input in everything from our community health improvement plan to emerging issues. And so I wanted to give that context, knowing that it might not be as familiar to some of you. Go ahead, Taylor. If I got that wrong, please correct me.
No, it's great. Thank you. Today, I am presenting a request on behalf of CHAB, Community Health Advisory Board, to renew a membership for, sorry, I just lost my place.
Melissa Fresh Brown.
Thank you. Melissa Fresh Brown, for an additional 3-year term. As we have gone through this process, we've been trying to catch up with some memberships that have lapsed in the last year. So this is one of the last of those folks who need to have their membership renewed, who've requested for it to be renewed. Moving forward, we should be on track with everybody as their memberships come up for renewal in real time. So yes, Melissa represents the sector of community stakeholder. She wears multiple hats in our community, one of which is a leader of our Opportunity Council here for Island County. So she plays a critical role on our CHAB and as a leader in our community. And so it is the recommendation of the Community Health Advisory Board to extend or renew her membership for another 3-year term. And that is why we're here today.
Any questions? We have one Scrivener's error. You have Bob Urich down at the bottom. I think we reappointed him earlier.
Thank you.
Late last year. So just correcting that in the memorandum.
Yes, I will update that. Appreciate you so noting that.
I move to approve renewing a 3-year membership term for this CHAB member.
Second.
So we have a motion, a second, to approve Melissa Fresh Brown to CHAB for a 3-year term. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
We had a big agenda, but we're moving quickly.
It's full.
Sorry, I'm trying to share.
Sean, if the 340B comes up and they require testimony, if you'd reach out immediately to either of us to speak on that issue.
Yeah.
Is that okay with you?
Sure. Yeah.
Because often I'll get an email the day before it's coming to committee, and I'm happy to come in remotely or submit written testimony.
It went through Senate committee last Thursday, but it would then go through House Committee on Health and Wellness, so I can track that.
Thank you. Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily Wildman. I'm the Housing Program Manager here for Island County. And I'm here to give some updates for at the federal level, some HUD updates, and then how that impacts us here locally. So housing in 2025, there was a lot of shifts. So kind of at the beginning of housing in 2025, everyone was kind of on the same wavelength of that stable housing has a lack of stable housing has a negative impact on overall health and life expectancy. And in fact, people who are experiencing homelessness die nearly 30 years earlier than the average American. And that's why it's so important to the Board of Health to talk about housing and keep that in the forefront. This kind of the standard of belief, the reasons for our housing crisis were caused by a lack of housing supply, rising rents with an increasing income gap. So people were not making any more money, but their rents were going up. Lack of access to services such as mental health, behavioral health, hospital, physical health care, limited shelter resources, the need for more permanent supportive housing. A lot of small communities lack permanent supportive housing because it can be quite expensive to operate. And the history of housing discrimination in the United States, Washington State, Island County, that led to people of color not being homeowners and not being able to pass on that generational wealth. The current administration and HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Agency, has some very different ideas on what is good for housing and homelessness in the country. And there was a notice of funding that was put out by HUD in 2024 that was supposed to fund 2024 and 2025. And this was for the continuum of care. And the continuum of care is in Washington State, the five largest counties are their own continuum of care, so they apply directly for federal funding. And then the 34 small and medium counties, including Island County, they apply for funding federally as a group. So there is somebody at the Department of Commerce that organizes all that. So if, for example, Ryan's House for Youth wants to apply for federal funding, it's put into a large application with all the other 34 counties, and any organization that is applying and put in as one. So this was this NOFO was released for that CO the balance of state that's called. And the funding was supposed to be through fiscal year 2025. But at the mid-November, the federal government came out and said that they were canceling that second year of funding and they were going to put out a new NOFO. And our attorney general for Washington State, along with several other states, sued to stop that. And also the National Alliance on Homelessness and some coalitions across the United States also sued so that it would potentially stop this for the nation. And the a judge at the U.S. District Court did rule for stopping this, changed the NOFO and said that they did need to fund it. And then in January or this month, last week, it's all been moving pretty quickly. HUD announced that they were going to, in fact, do that, but they're not going to actually give out any money to fund that second year until this works its way through the courts. So agencies can apply for this funding to, it's basically a renewal of funding. So it's not for new programs, it's just to fund what's currently being funded. But they're not going to guarantee that they fund it until this goes through the court system. And the biggest reason that this was so concerning was these policy changes that were going to be incorporated into this NOFO. And now basically it has it's paused it. So they're not going to make these changes right now because they're in the middle of a cycle. But these changes are coming. They will be in the new NOFO that will probably come out this summer or fall. And the biggest one that is most concerning to everyone is that it will have a 30% cap to permanent supportive housing. Currently in the United States, this funding covers about 80% of the funding goes towards permanent supportive housing. So that would be a massive cut in Washington State and in the country. That is the biggest concern. And there are work and service requirements for this. So that is another big change. The service requirements were pretty small for this funding. And now it's going to be 40 hours of work of either work, volunteering, school. And for a lot of people who are our most vulnerable citizens, that is very challenging. It also is anti-harm reduction models. And so harm reduction is basically like lower barrier housing first models where you're not kicked out or excluded from housing because you have a criminal history or because you are have active substance abuse. There are still rules to these places, but it's not it does not exclude you for having that those things. So the policy changes would say, no, we don't believe in harm reduction. And in fact, if you are engaging in harm reduction, you will not qualify. You'll just be automatically excluded from this funding. And the same with the anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, also known more widely as DEI. If you are engaged in any sort of DEI policies within your organization, that would exclude you from this funding automatically. There's even some talk about if you've ever been in this, it would exclude you from this funding. And that can be quite complicated because many organizations braid their funding. They have federal funding, they have state funding, they have county funding. And so if the state and the federal funding don't align, your policies have to go to the most restrictive, which can then be against your state funding or your local funding. So it excludes a lot of programs from applying. What is the impact, the direct impact on this? Cuts in permanent supportive housing. So that would be felt throughout the state. So we have some permanent supportive housing coming on board as we speak in Oak Harbor. We have 8 new units. We will hopefully have 8 more units at a new project that's hopefully going to be breaking ground this year. And the funding for that is going to be much more challenging to come by because of this 50%, cut in permanent supportive housing funding from the federal government. So any sort of state funding will become that much more competitive and make it much more difficult to bring on any more permanent supportive housing. At this point, their priority will just be maintaining what we have in the state. People losing their housing because they cannot find or maintain work. Many people are struggle with maintaining work for a variety of reasons, lack of childcare, mental health, family obligations. And so this would basically mean that if you moved into a project that funded by this and you lost your job, then you could be asked to move out pretty quickly. Those households with substance abuse issues will remain homeless, or if they relapse, could then lose their housing. And communities will lose gains made in equitable housing outcomes for BIPOC and LGBTQ plus households.
Can you pause?
Because
you're giving us a lot of information. No, it's really important. And I just want to make sure if people have questions, I don't want to interrupt you on every point, but I just want to give a minute to ask.
Yeah, I have an issue with the work requirements. I mean, these seem pretty draconian. And I'm a little concerned about it because you have a lot of people that may be in rehab or have transportation issues
Yes.
or mental disabilities or physical disabilities. How rigid are these going to be? And is there going to be a monitoring system that goes around and checks on all this?
Those
Is there
are
any exceptions?
all good questions, and I think that it's not clear on the answers to those. I think that the plan is to monitor by they'll be reporting from these organizations, and if they're not meeting a certain threshold, then they would lose their funding. The exceptions it didn't seem like there were a lot of exceptions. There were very few exceptions, and so that is why there is such a concern. There's also a lack there's not a lot of employment out there currently. There's a lot of large, like a Walmart that's saying they're not going to be expanding their workforce at all because they're moving to AI and they're moving to self-checkout and all of that. So it's a grave concern that people won't be able to make these requirements.
Some years ago, the Board of Island County Commissioners passed a resolution, excuse me, 1/10 of 1% law for affordable housing. and it was for creating new affordable housing units. We revised that. We updated it last year to include purchasing existing units that could be transformed to affordable housing. I would appreciate it if the Human Services group could go back and look at the legislation that allowed us to do that, to see if that legislation allows us to possibly have the conversation about expanding what we do to assist in this in any way. So I'd be interested in having a review of the legislation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
When the federal government put into place some of these, you use the word draconian, so I'll use it, requirements on Medicaid that included work requirements, the concurrent burden was increasing the frequency of reporting. I believe you guys have this, and the administrative burden of making those, of reporting that. So, in addition to the impact on the consumer, it's also a significant in terms of administrative cost and the administrative burden of reporting out and how the, and they've yet not created a clear pathway of how any of that's going to be audited. So it has, I have the same concerns about this that I had when they implemented the Medicaid cuts earlier this year and added those different requirements to those folks who are receiving Medicaid. Did you recall that? I think so.
Yeah.
The 30% cap to permanent supportive housing, I just need to take you back to where you started. Is this all referring to housing and urban development funding?
Yes.
So the fact that SAMHSA, for example, has historically been a significant funder for permanent supportive housing, do any of these things, and that's a federal source of funding, do any of these affect things like SAMHSA or our other federal funding sources, or is it just HUD funding?
It's currently just HUD funding, but if you had a like there's a lot of large permanent supportive housing developments and they braid in several funding sources. So you wouldn't be able to just operate under this for this unit and this for this unit. It would impact it indirectly. And then potentially, I think depending on how much pushback there is on this, then it could trickle into other funding sources.
And at one point in my recent history, which isn't all that recent, the older I get, you could use Medicaid and other, like under the title, the waiver program, you could attach Medicaid dollars to help offset housing needs like permanent supporting off housing. Is that also under threat then?
Not today, but I think that's definitely a potential.
We'll let you move on to seniors.
Um,
Thank
and
you.
just really quick, also, just on Friday, the Washington State Department of Commerce released this kind of summary of all of this, and I'll send it out to Melissa to distribute to everybody. It's a
Yeah.
really useful document. So I wanted to talk a little bit about seniors because that is one of our most vulnerable populations. We have a large senior population in this community, and we are seeing a large increase in our senior homeless population. In 2019, there were six seniors who were 62 and over served at the Haven, our night-by-night shelter. And in 2025, that number grew to 25 people. So that's a huge increase. In our office, when I started in 2018, we in our homeless housing unit, we weren't doing any sort of COPES assessments. Now that's a very regular thing. We're seeing an increase in seniors.
Oops, you want to define that for people?
COPES is a, I don't remember the
The
acronym.
acronym.
But it's a assessment for anyone needing assisted living who it's being paid through Medicaid or Medicare, and the state comes and does a whole assessment on your ability
Activities of
for,
daily living and
yes,
so forth.
activities
So
of.
it's, yeah, I don't mean to put you on the
No.
spot, but Northwest Regional Council, I think, does most of the COPES assessments in this area, and it's activities of daily living and the things that, Claire, help you define eligibility to live in a higher level of care. How's that? Is that easier?
Yes, thank
And I
you.
don't know what COPE stands for anymore either. It's been too many years.
And so we are seeing an increase of people who are going to the Haven, for example, where the homeless housing program is completely separate from assisted living, and they serve under separate guidelines. They're not allowed to help somebody out of bed. They're not allowed to help somebody in the shower. They're not allowed to help somebody get onto the toilet. And so we're seeing this increased number of people who are at a very high level of need. The COPES process takes a couple months, and we're seeing them at the Haven, and the Haven is in this really bad position of, do we keep somebody and put ourselves at liability, or do we turn them away and then they're spending outside, they're living outside, and
Oh, God.
it's a really horrible situation. And this unfortunately is increasing throughout the nation. We're seeing because our population is aging, and we're seeing that in greater numbers in our homeless population. And because your life expectancy is shorter, your health needs tend to arise at a much earlier age
I
than
need
the general population.
We also saw the bands move up. So 62 and over was 62 through 100, but our demographics in this county has actually moved up so that those of us, so that the bands, we're actually seeing people older. And I will remember a report you gave us after the one night count for homelessness where we had someone in the 90s that was in the Haven.
Yeah.
And so they're not only are they 62 and over, but they're more likely to be even older and in that 85 plus population in our census data.
Yes.
Scares me.
Very scary. So some of the federal policies and how it will impact our seniors is that senior housing already has very, very long lists, a wait list for our subsidized housing. And those lists currently are 7+ years in a lot of the subsidized housing. And so any seniors who are in permanent supportive housing that are going to now, if the permanent supportive housing is cut and now becomes transitional housing, seniors, that's not realistic for seniors. Transitional housing is the idea is that you transition out. You have higher income, you're able to do it on your own. That is not realistic for seniors. And so there's going to be longer wait lists for subsidized housing. More seniors will be asked to leave emergency shelters because they will be out of permanent supportive housing and back in the emergency shelter arena. We have seniors with substance abuse issues, and we already see that as a struggle and a barrier. In assisted living facilities, we've had a few seniors who've gone and not been successful because they couldn't manage their behavior and their substance abuse issues. And so they will now remain homeless, not even have the chance to get in, or they will lose their housing if they relapse. And then seniors will have work slash service requirements. Currently, seniors have to work until 65. We're already the age to receive Social Security for anyone born 1960 and over is now 67. They have not shifted that for Medicare, but is it been discussed? Yes, it has. So then you're potentially looking at seniors who have not only service requirements, but work requirements into their late 60s. So that is very concerning for a population that is already so vulnerable and has such a lack of housing. And there are policy impacts for every age group, but I just really wanted to highlight the seniors because that's such a big issue in our community.
So, what is the agency that says someone who's 68 years old will have to keep working in order to receive services?
So right now, that would be it depends on So right now, to draw Social Security, which if you're born 1960 and over, is now bumped up to 67 years old. And so Medicare right now, and Medicaid, they're still at the 65. So you can get on Medicare at 65. So the Medicaid work requirements would not apply at 65. But if they choose to align the Medicare and the Social Security and bump that to 67, then you would be bumping, that would be, it would be the Social Security Administration and the Medicaid and Medicare administration that would be making those decisions.
Medicaid already has work
Congress.
requirements. So, and is there an age range of which the Medicaid, because the Medicare, Medicaid are the duals, is there an age requirement on Medicaid?
So there's a work requirement,
I mean, is work requirement by age, that's what I meant.
yeah, because at 65 you'd be eligible to switch to Medicare, so that's when your work requirement would end, right? Any other questions? So just quickly, I also wanted to announce that we have our annual point in time count where we count our homeless population and survey them. That is next Thursday, January 29th. So you'll see people out in the community trying to get connect with everybody who's experiencing homelessness in our community. And we're also working on the 5-year homeless housing plan that aligns with the housing element in the comprehensive plan. And that draft will be available online tomorrow afternoon.
Question.
Yes.
Do you have any idea how many homeless people there are on the county right now?
That's a great question. So last year, for literally homeless, so living outside in their car, the number I believe was about 80, and they said the idea is that is undercounted by 2 to 3, so multiply that by 2.5. I can't do that math that quickly, but that's over 200 people. And there is this new tool that is highlighted in the plan that's called the homelessness snapshot, and that's taking data from all like from the homeless management system, from SNAP benefits, from Medicare and Medicaid. And that is saying for more like unstably housed, so people who could be homeless at any moment, that's putting it up over 1,200 people in Island County that are either homeless or at very high risk of homelessness. Any other questions? Thank you.
Do you want to, before you leave the questions of homeless, in the population of folks who are homeless, so the one night count is, or the one day count is underestimated because A, it's done in January, which is an odd time to do it, and B, you don't get to see everyone. Our volunteers and staff do not go places that are unsafe in order to account. Like many of our service providers in Island County, our human service providers, our community resource center, they actually can tell you where they know people are living. But if it's an area we consider unsafe, we do not send volunteers or staff in there. So that's why the estimate of 2 and 2.5 times or 2 to 3 times higher. And in that than unstably housed. Can you talk a little bit about the demographics of who those folks are? You talked a little bit about how many of them were in the older population. In my younger idealistic days, when we had the zero homelessness vision in our state, and some counties achieved zero homelessness for families with young children. That was achieved. Can you talk about sort of the who these people are that are unstably housed and homeless? Could you talk just a little bit of picture of who these folks are?
Sure. I mean, I would say that we've seen increases in every age group and every kind of demographic. We have more young people that are homeless. We have more families. We used to be able to, a family would come in and we could pretty much get them into shelter, within a few days. and those times are over. We at times have over five families waiting for shelter to get into a program that are either living in their car, maybe they're living in a tent in their family's backyard. Kids are staying at grandma's while mom's in her car. So we're seeing an increase of that. There's still a large overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the homeless population throughout the country, including Island County. And so I would say every age group we have seen a rise, and it is very concerning because that there is not, like, with kind of these new policies, it just seems like those numbers are going to continue to increase.
Do you see working families in our homeless population, folks who are employed but maybe don't have where their income doesn't enable them to achieve housing?
For sure, that the rents are very high, and it we see people who are working, and then it's very hard to maintain your job once you lose your housing. So they may have been able to patch things together. They got behind on their rent, they got evicted, then they lost their job. And there's also people that are working who do not want to be known. They don't want, they're afraid that their kids will be taken away. They're afraid they're going to get in trouble for where they're parking. And so we have people in cars that do not want to engage because out of fear, for getting in trouble.
We had a young woman we met when we were doing our outreach at Hoffman Road who was working two jobs and still trying to find, and still in that situation. Do you have veterans who are homeless?
Yes, I think that we Opportunity Council and Island County Human Services does a great job at wrapping around veterans when we discover that they're homeless, but it takes time. So homeless veterans can qualify for what's called a VASH voucher, but it can be hard to find housing within the range of the voucher of how much it will pay, and that's also become a problem throughout the state and country, is that rents have risen so high that even with a voucher, it's very challenging to find a place that's within the rental amount that the voucher covers. And so that can take months for people to, even though they qualify for a voucher, it can take months to find something.
When Kata was here last year and presenting on some of this, the sort of scary stories of our vulnerable children and folks in domestic violence situations, have we seen an increase in people seeking shelter due to situations like that?
Yeah, we in fact just had a woman in our office last week who's undocumented and is afraid to go to the police, was afraid to go to CADA because she was afraid she's going to be deported if she reports any of this. And her husband had assaulted her that morning. And so we're seeing definitely an increase in domestic violence. All of the factors that lead to that increase, poverty, unemployment, substance abuse, mental health, all of those are rising. And so domestic violence is rising along with that.
And you mentioned harm reduction and our desire to help people find a path to sobriety. There's sometimes a public narrative out there that all those people on the streets are active abusers not wanting any help. What's your answer to that public perception?
I think that no one is going to turn down housing. I do think there are the more rules and barriers you put up for people in the beginning, that can be harder for them to manage. But there has not ever been anybody who has said, no, I don't want to be housed. Everybody wants housing. There are a lot of factors that make it hard for them to get in and maintain their housing, but that's just not, it's not true. The struggle is meeting people where they're at, and it's a wide spectrum of where people are at.
I just needed to put a human face on this because I can tell a story of someone in my district who was a mom leaving a very unhealthy situation, had two boys. They lost their housing because the place they were renting was sold. They were living in a car. They trying their best. One child had special needs. In about 6 months to a year, she managed to get into a workforce development program while living in their car, kept her boys in school, got her son into a teen youth employment program, and eventually was able to exit the housing supportive services into stable housing and a stable job. That is not, in my experience, uncommon. That is a common story of people who want to move on and out. And so I just needed to put a human face on the statistics and the stories you're telling, because these could be anyone's child, mother, grandmother. When I think about someone, you know, you all, many of you know, I'm a caregiver and take care of a 92-year-old mother who's in an adult family home. And there, but for the grace of God, would any of us go
right
with someone we love? So I just needed to have a human face on this story.
Yeah. And
thank you.
Thank you.
So do we have another topic, Sean, that maybe...
Yes. I'll invite up.
I think
that's a
child fatality review. Although you don't look like Jen Prenz.
Well, it's Jen and myself, but it's actually going to be me presenting today. Jen is online if there's any questions I can't answer. But for those who don't know me, my name is Megan Works. I'm the community health manager here at Island County Public Health. And I'm actually presenting twice today, but this first topic is the child fatality review. So Island County Public Health is in the process of formalizing a child fatality review program with the goal of launching this year. For those unfamiliar with what child fatality review is, it is a formal, comprehensive, multidisciplinary review of a child's death to better understand how and why children die, identify risk factors leading to fatalities. Then we can therefore recommend strategies to prevent further child fatalities. Historically, CFR, or Child Fatality Review, has had far-reaching impacts. Things like safe sleep campaigns, drowning prevention, education, and policies around teen driving, bicycle helmets comes to mind too. These are all work that was guided out of Child Fatality Review. Local health departments in Washington State are authorized and encouraged to conduct these reviews to identify and address preventable causes of child mortality. Currently, 11 LHJs in the state have these programs. So criteria for what we would be looking at in these reviews would be looking at children age 0 to 18, including infants, Island County residents who died in Island County, and review accidents, suicides, homicides, undetermined deaths. A child who passes of natural causes would not be reviewed. So what is our timeline for this? Next steps with approval. So in March, we are looking to form a review committee to include the coroner, who has been an instrumental part in this. Representatives from entities such as local public health, social and human services, healthcare, and law enforcement. And then in April, we'd have an initial meeting to set expectations, including confidentiality requirements and review historical data. Then in the summer, convene the committee to discuss the first set of cases, and then have probably an annual meeting cadence after that. Just for context, over the past 10 years, there have been 22 child fatalities that would meet this criteria. So not a lot. That's good. We don't want a lot. So low numbers are great in this aspect. But just to give you an idea of how frequently these reviews would be conducted. Any questions?
Couple. So the review would occur whenever a fatality occurs. You wouldn't wait until we have three of them and then
no, we wouldn't, no, because we'd want to look into that as soon as possible. And the meeting cadence, we say annually, but that's malleable, and that, you know, it's really determinant on how many we have at any given moment.
What if any involvement will the Board of Health have in this process?
So once we've conducted our reviews, that's information we can bring back to Board of Health to help. Not only does it kind of guide our prevention work in the in the health department, but it also it's stuff we can bring back to Board of Health to kind of look at from a broader sense. Like, are there any policy changes that need to happen that we can advocate for? That sort of thing. So yes, Board of Health would play an integral role in these in this process.
Yeah, on your reporting, assuming you get your information from the local coroner, do they have reports with the private funeral directors that they turn in?
I'm not 100% sure on that. But anytime there's a case like this, there's usually like a medical examiner review, coroner review. If before I believe it goes to the funeral director, I think I'm still learning this process myself. So, and I'm not sure exactly how that would work, but most of it would be informed by the coroner, and then we would identify like what kind of case it was to identify like other partners we may need to pull in for that review.
And then, do you have a record of how many SIDS we get? Do we still have a problem with that? And I'm sure Dr. Gasper might be able to add some of that too, because I believe he's involved in pediatrics. My wife, your wife is, yes.
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I could definitely look that up and get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Does this supplant child fatality re reviews of children who are in care?
Anytime there's an undetermined death, I think the criteria is on what happened. I guess if it's undetermined, if it wasn't natural causes, we would get it. Period. Dep Yeah.
I'm in the RCW.
Of course.
Not surprising. If the team identifies a current reportable or unresolved resolved concern about a child abuse or neglect, it may designate one member to make a report to the child abuse hotline. Does not create a mandatory review for any individual to aid, and then it goes into aid in the child fatality review. We know there's a separate law that says any child who dies while in the care of the state, in other words, while in foster care or in an institution, or
Right.
that must be initiate a review. I assume we don't get in the way of that, because if you have two concurrent processes, it would worry me that there could be conflation and confusion. And so I just want to make sure that what we do doesn't interfere with those kinds of investigations that are required by law in the death of a child.
No. And I'm assuming what you're kind of getting at is if it were like a we would look, well, no, we're not part of the law enforcement investigation, if that's kind of what, yeah, it's,
Well, it's a child fatality review is what they call them, but I just want
yeah.
to make sure that we take second step
Yes.
behind those investigations. But, or even, and this has never happened, but if a child dies in care, if a child dies in psychiatric care, in anything where there's a mandated, we would take, I don't want us to, if we're doing this is voluntary. We are not a mandated county for
Correct.
child fatality reviews. So if we're doing it, I want to make sure we take second step behind the mandated reviews that are for the purpose of determining cause, right?
100%. And you know, we're looking at this for more just from a prevention standpoint. Not a,
Janet,
oh,
Jen
Jen,
Kranz
yes.
wants to speak. Jen, thank you.
Hi, can you all hear me?
Nope.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
That's better.
There you go. Now
Silly
you can.
question. I just wanted to say that I'm not sure if you can even see me, but that's
Nope.
okay. But the with these review meetings, DCYF is a collaborator, so there's generally a DCYF representative at these meetings, and they contribute their piece to it. So it might be an investigation that they're conducting, but They also will provide information into the county CFR process. So it's more of a collaborative effort.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
I just want to say, I think this is very important work, and I am grateful that the county's taking it on. So thank you.
Course. Okay.
Before diving into the next topic, I asked Megan if I could jump in because we've had some late breaking news sharing the agenda just around the measles outbreak in Snohomish County. And just to quickly give the board some context on that before the discussion on childhood immunizations. So, as I've shared over email, as of January 16th, last Friday, the Snohomish County Health Department has officially declared a measles outbreak. And this follows three new confirmed cases in local children. This is after a family visiting from South Carolina, where they're having a regional measles outbreak. They visited community locations, and now we have three kiddos local who are positive. This family from South Carolina, they did visit the Mukilteo Clinton Ferry December 30th between 1 and 3 p.m. And so we're sharing out all the potential exposure site locations. They didn't get off the ferry and come into South Whidbey, but again, we're sharing all the locations. And our top message to the community is just, the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is our most powerful defense. It is 97% effective at preventing measles after two doses. And high vaccination rates are really the main way we prevent this outbreak from, crossing county lines and spreading. We'll talk about some of our numbers, which are a bit concerning. We've seen some decline as well as across Washington state. For MMR vaccine, we were aiming for that 95% vaccination level to reach herd immunity to prevent outbreak. So we want folks to check their vaccination status, get vaccinated if they're not. For older adults, if you're born after 1957 and vaccinated before 1976, thanks to Jen Krenz for help with this, we are advising these individuals to consult with their provider about receiving an updated dose to ensure they are protected. We're also asking that if people have been to an exposure sites and have any symptoms, there's a call before you go directive. Specifically, if you have fever and rash, call either provider, call our department. We're sharing our number before seeking in-person care so we can ensure that there's isolation protocols in place to prevent the spread of virus. Measles, highly contagious, highly contagious. So our communicable disease team, Megan and team, have done an outstanding job just staying in contact with Snohomish County, Department of Health, all of our healthcare providers, and we're continuing to share out current protocols and updated information, and we will just stay on this and keep the board informed.
Howard, I noticed you've joined us. Do you have anything to add to that? Howard Librand is our health officer.
I'm not fully joined. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Can you make him, Howard should always come in as a panelist, just FYI. Okay. Go ahead, Howard. We'll let you talk and we won't be able to see you.
Okay.
Don't mind.
Right. Just measles is such an example of the good that vaccines have done. And the there's not a lot of baggage that came along with the measles vaccine, like people perceive that there are with other vaccines. And it is so contagious, and the vaccine is so effective that it is far and away the prime tool we have to prevent measles disease and measles deaths. And there certainly have been and will continue to be measles deaths if we continue to have measles cases. So I just reiterate that this is a poster child for why you should get vaccines. And I couldn't talk before, but when we were talking about the child death review,
Yes.
It's not the terminology that's used now. It just, I guess the perception maybe came across that this is to help determine the cause of death in some way. But it's really not. It's like Jen mentioned, it's totally prevention, and it's a way to look at why kids are dying. I mean, there is no such thing as death from natural causes in a kid, in my mind. And if they are dying of natural causes, I mean, let's change the natural causes. And homelessness is one of those that we know has an effect on mortality. I mean, we just talked about that. It's an opportunity that you get in a sort of worst case scenario, to analyze a situation and put things in place, for prevention. And, that's mostly what was said. I just wanted to reiterate that too, that, the death of a child, no matter what it's from, just isn't something we can take lightly, and it's something that we should base every available prevention measure to take every prevention measure to make sure that doesn't happen again. And everything from seatbelt laws, helmet laws, those sorts of things all sort of stem from the fact that we've analyzed what's killing our kids, and we've tried to put a plan in place to keep that from happening.
Thank you.
So, yeah, thanks, Megan, for going over some of this. I will just say with the immunization piece, we've talked with the board about the childhood vaccine program we're planning, and these numbers really reinforce why it's so important, and we appreciate the board's support in that.
So here's a snapshot of childhood immunization rates in Island County, currently. Overall, childhood immunization rates are declining. For children in the 19 to 35 month category and children in the 4 to 6 age year categories, overall vaccine completion decreased by 10% from 2020 to 2025. In 2024, 45% in the 19 to 35 month category and 18% in the 4 to 6 year age category completed their vaccination series as recommended by the CDC schedule at that time. These percents are much lower than the state average. Compliance goes up a little bit when it comes to back to when it comes to school age. However, 83% of students have all their required immunizations, and that's again lower than the state average of 87%. Definitely not trending the way we want it to be.
Some of our school districts actually achieved over 90% vaccination in following the law that passed requiring vaccinations in our schools. Can't remember the number, but that's okay. We had South Whidbey School District, I know exceeded the 90%, and I think Stanwood Camino, their fourth graders were over 90%. So then the pandemic hit
Right.
and access to care fell off. Pediatric, that was part of it. What else do you see as the cause for these declines?
Right. So, in putting this together, our team went and spoke with local school nurses, pediatricians to kind of get their take on what they're seeing every day. And the biggest things that came up, one was access. Two was misinformation hesitancy as a big issue. And just about availability. There's currently three CVP providers, which is Childhood Vaccine Program. Just a little background in the Childhood Vaccine Program. It's a program through the Washington State Department of Health that supplies certain vaccines to providers free of cost for insured and insured patients. Essentially, they want every child to have access to vaccine without any cost barrier. And we have three of those CVP providers in the county, and those include Pediatric Associates of Whidbey, Whidbey Health Primary Care, and Skagit Regional Health on Camino. The Navy also does provide vaccines to their dependents who have a primary care provider on at the Naval Clinic. A lot of people also, and actually, let me back up a little bit. One of the things as far as access goes, and while we have these providers on island, it's not always easy to get an appointment. There's usually, if they are accepting new patients, which they're not always all the time, one of the issues is that are they accepting new patients? And even if they are, you may wait up to 3 months. And so if you're trying to get your kid caught up, that it's a barrier. It's a very big barrier. I know a lot of people would rely on pharmacies, but that's been another not reliable source of vaccines, just because we've had a lot of pharmacy turnover in the county, where pharmacies close, or some of them do offer childhood vaccines, but only at certain ages, and some only accept certain insurances. So, really, what we're looking at here is we want to address the access problem. That's something we can address. We've also worked with local pediatricians and school nurses to develop a campaign. But changing hearts and minds takes time. So that's an ongoing thing. Public health is all about education, and we will always educate. But the access piece is something we can address in the moment. And so we are in the process of applying to become childhood vaccine providers here at Island County Public Health, which is really exciting. And so kind of our timeline on that. We are planning to put in our application in March. What we're kind of waiting on right now is we're kind of in limbo. Our vaccine room, which is currently housed at the North Whidbey Family Resource Center in Oak Harbor, we're moving buildings. And part of this whole process is getting an inspection of our facilities. And so we were advised to wait till we have everything moved and set up and ready to go. So in March, we will start that formal process of the application. We also have to have an inspection. They'll have to come out and inspect our facilities, make sure everything is good to go as far as storage, handling, making sure we have all the right procedures, policies in place. We're working on getting order sets together. And finalizing all that, getting staff. There's certain trainings that have to be done to make sure that all this is done correctly. But also, what we're really looking at is back to school pop-ups. That's where we want to hone in right now, is getting kids before we send them off to these massively congregate settings to get them all up to date, lower that barrier of access. And this is just kind of a safety net for Island County residents to be able to access vaccines if they can't get an appointment, and make sure that we're doing our part from a public health standpoint. So what we're going to be doing is some pop-ups with our new wellness wagon van of probably late July, early August, leading all the way up until school starts with all the school districts in the county. So we'll be moving around a lot and doing these pop-up clinics, which is really exciting. So,
You have refrigeration on the North Whidbey Family Resource Center, and you have refrigeration on the Camino Family Resource Center. Do you have refrigeration facilities on the South Whidbey Family Resource Center?
not anymore. So with these, this is the other beauty of pop-ups. We have portable containers for the vaccines that we can take with us anywhere, whether there's a vaccine fridge there or not. As long as we have one central location to store them properly, where it's being monitored, then that's kind of the big piece. But we have all, because of COVID, we're set up very well. We have all of the portable things to take them base anywhere in the county, in the van. So.
I need to ask the question about funding.
Right.
So, can you address funding and staffing this enterprise?
Of course. So, as an LHJ, we would receive these vaccines through the childhood vaccine program for free. There is an option to bill an administration fee, but honestly, we're trying to make this super low barrier for people. We don't want to do that. Honestly, the vaccine's free. The really only cost to us would be staff time and supplies. And that's very doable with this pop-up model.
We
So,
don't need to hire more public health nurses, I guess.
no. Any
Are
other
you
questions?
hoping to do it this year?
Oh, yes, that's our goal anyway. But obviously we want to make sure that this is done very well. So, if we don't make that goal, then but really, I think we can by this year, by this school year, or next school year, I guess.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm curious, Mr. Boulder. So if my child needs vaccines, are they able to go, does the hospital provide that service?
I can't tell you accurately, although I'll tell you, we adopted a couple of children and they were unvaccinated, and we took them down to the State Department of Health. And they gave them all the free back. They gave all the vaccines they needed, which was quite a few, all for free. So I know it's available through the state, but I cannot tell you if we have that in our hospital or not.
Yes. Oh,
Just to jump in, the Whidbey Health primary care location is one of our CVP providers, our childhood vaccine program providers. So, and
sorry.
then the Coopville Pharmacy as well, they have MMR, they have Tdap. I believe they're ages 3 and up. We can confirm that. But for older kids who are catching up, it's a great location. You can pop in. So, yeah.
There's often been this discussion of our pharmacies provide this, but many of the pharmacies won't do the babies.
That's right. Yeah.
So it is one of the access to care barriers is, yes, I can go in and get my annual flu shot. They don't worry about poking me, but many of our pharmacies do not want to poke infants and young children. And some, they don't even take them below age 12, if I'm recalling that correctly.
And we lost SARS, which was one of our main CVP providers.
We lost SARS. We lost a pharmacy on South Whidbey. We've lost the only pharmacy on Camino. We've lost one of two pharmacies in Stanwood. The challenges that you talked about around just the challenge of being a pharmacy. Has led to according to a state report, I saw a critical decrease in the number of pharmacies we have in our state.
Okay, our next item, and I'll try to keep this concise. So this is a follow-up
Got
from
half an hour, Sean, and then we're going to kick you out of here.
that works. This is a follow-up from the policy docket process we discussed at the December meeting. So we're trying to get that proposed docket to the board for a vote for the year. We're already moving ahead on some of the items you'll see here, like the maternal child health resolution, just simply due to timing and some of the legislative advocacy work. So we've brought this through CHAB. They have ranked these policies and their priorities. They're still working through that. We can follow up with the board with that averaged ranking. And today the ask is that the board review these items. If you feel ready to rank, one being low priority, two medium, three high priority, high is urgent that we address this year. You're welcome to start, but we can collect this via email following the meeting. So I'll just briefly introduce the items in groups, and then we, yeah, go
I just got confused because low is one and not one is high
Yes.
priority.
Yeah. We worked through that with chat as well.
Counterintuitive for me.
It is a bit, yeah, it is. So the first group, governance and strategy, focuses on, how we operate, items like potentially developing board bylaws to formalize roles and meeting process, and our strategic vision framework and strategic planning. Item two looks at code and planning reviews. These are major technical updates. And these are things actually we're going to be doing. The department is focused on like the sanitary code update and local management plan and the coordinated water systems plan, but still getting that board input is helpful. And then group C is around programs and clinical services. We've already talked about the child fatality review. We've talked about the childhood vaccine program. And at the November meeting, we discussed the Thrive Resource Directory, which we're moving forward on. But there are some other items in here around, strengthening our food safety program and modernizing some of the procedures that guide that program, and developing greater coordination with behavioral health agencies in our environmental health regulations around septic and solid waste. So the last item, or the group D, not the last, is legislative and advocacy. So this is our voice that the board can provide to the state level. Includes our 2026 legislative agenda. So we've already ticked one box earlier in the meeting, and then specific advocacy around key funding like foundational public health services, and of course, funding that impacts our hospital district. And then the last group around proclamations. So these are the formal recognitions of specific health issues throughout the year, like we did today with maternal health. And there's a number that are scattered throughout the year. I would share, as we've shared with CHAB, we proposed a list that we feel, even if we moved ahead with all of it, it's achievable, that we can get this done this year. But if there are items that can wait, we'll get the feedback from you all and then bring the proposed docket to the February meeting for a vote.
I always said life happens when you're making plans.
Yeah.
So this is achievable. Does the board have questions? Do you feel like this is a lot to digest, I think. And this is a new, in some way, I know Sean has talked with the three commissioners. I'm not sure how much I had asked him last year to reach out to you all as well about a more disciplined approach to our public health docket. Do you feel like taking this and reviewing it and getting back to Sean individually with questions, or do you feel like you need him to reach out to you? What are your thoughts? And Catlin, we definitely, while you don't take a vote, we definitely want your input given the importance of NASWI in our community on this docket.
Set up time to walk through this with the board members between now and February.
At least with Mayor Wright and our others, I think it's critical. The commissioners can certainly reach out to you. I've had the privilege of being able to discuss this a bit more, and it's a lot to digest, so I want to make sure no one feels overwhelmed by all of this.
I'm good. Just did it.
Okay. All right. So if you would reach out just if people have questions, and especially to Mayor Wright, or whoever he delegates this to, I think it's new and different, and this feels rather, we're kind of experiencing this compact driven agenda today, and I welcome feedback on whether it's too much, too little, too fast, too slow. We've had a lot. Part of this is some things we pushed off from last fall.
Yeah.
The child fatality review was supposed to happen last year, I believe.
Yeah, we had a number of early year priorities to move on, and next year we'll start this whole process in the fall. So we're teeing it up for 2027. I'll set up those meetings, and I could address any of the specific items here now. I kept it by groups to keep the agenda moving and considering timing. But if there are any specific questions about any of the individual proposals,
Would you make sure you reach out to Commissioner Johnson when she returns?
I will. And just to share, this is what the actual docket looks like and what we'll bring forward for a vote once we have that input.
And we may need to allow time in February for kind of robust discussion. I'm looking at time. I'm just going to wonder, Taylor, if for two reasons we could put off CHIP till February. One, because Commissioner Johnson's out this month, and when we set it on the agenda for this month, we didn't know she would be out, and it's a really, really important presentation for her to be present for, as well as just timing and making sure that the board has time with Sean's, if that's okay with the board. Okay, I would prefer, I just was, you know, we set this up last month, but it's really important that Jill be able to address this as well. So if that's the case, Sean, would you jump into the last few minutes and then a board discussion, I think is appropriate.
Yeah, so for the executive report, it's a lot of this information is there for you in the packet. I'll just touch on some of the highlights. We already talked about the Snohomish measles outbreak and the work we're doing there. Just around budget, we've met now with the Secretary of Health, all local health jurisdictions. The governor's budget did propose a $29 million reduction to foundational public health services to balance the deficit that the state is facing. We're also up against a $20 million annual loss from the vape tax revenue that funds foundational health services. So in February, we'll be bringing a resolution. We've worked with Wesolfo, and they have a resolution template that we'll adapt and bring forward. We're working through what this could mean. There are a number of bills currently trying to address the FPHS issue, and we'll provide the support as directed by the board from the legislative discussion earlier. And we'll continue to advocate for stable funding. The range it's hard to predict, but it could be anywhere from 150,000 to 400,000 annual loss to Island County for our department from this budget cycle. So that would take effect July 1st of 2026. And we're putting, mitigation measures in place for freezing vacant positions, and so that we can protect our core services. That's the big one. We're also, let's see, I mentioned WIC. We're navigating the shortfalls federally in the WIC program. There's a loss of funding for not accounting for the rising costs of doing business. We've applied for some additional funding through WIC, and we're waiting to hear on that. We have a backup source of funding, the Public Health Infrastructure Grant, that can maintain our level of service through 2027, regardless. I'll leave the rest of the information in the packet unless there are specific questions, and turn it back over to the board.
So the deficit being driven by an estimated 100 to 200,000 loss in annual vape tax revenue. Do we have fewer people vaping in Island County?
Well, and this is statewide. So, and then that's how much of that loss from the 20 million filters down to Island County. But statewide, we do have less people vaping. So that's great news from a public health standpoint. So we'll celebrate that.
There was some carve-out legislation being proposed, like with the marijuana tax and stuff, to make it go directly to counties. Can you bring forward any updates on that and whether we can negotiate that to backfill? We had a huge effort a few years ago for foundational public health. This board had Jamie Bodden come and present on what is foundational public health and what it means. And we are now, I'm not sure if with these two changes we'll see all of our gains wiped out or just a significant portion of them.
This would reset us, if this went through as is, it would reset us to about 2023 levels, which there was an exponential, a large increase in FPHS with 2020. Regardless, we receive around $2 million per year for our department. And so we're still receiving a significant portion, but it's such a core funding to our work, and it's helped us step off the, you know, the grant cycle where we need to always be applying for different grants.
It's also helped us transition out of current expense.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, very important.
And that's just money. I want to bring it back to people. It's our ability to respond to a TB case. One TB case can cost us $350,000. I mean, it's all of those things that come up, as well as the prevention work we've done with our youth. A number of those programs, our response during the pandemic, our public education and outreach, are the stuff we talked about today. You're sure depressing me today.
Well, there's some exciting ideas in the docket of constructive items to work on. So.
Emily, thank you for coming and being here. Megan, thank you for being here as well. Welcome, Dr. Gaspart. Thank you. And is there any board announcements?
I'm just curious, Janet. So both the Community Health Improvement Plan and the CHAB update, we will wait till Commissioner Johnson's back for both of those things?
Well, the CHIP update, I definitely wanted to wait till she was here because okay. We're at an important point. Do you have anything on CHAB?
Not formally. I would, if folks are interested in coming to our next CHAB meeting, we've moved the meeting dates. Officially, so they're the first Thursday of the month instead of the first Friday, and they occur from 1 to 3 p.m.
And they bounce around the county.
Correct. Yeah, all of our locations are listed on the CHAB's website, so you can see those in advance. And this next month, we'll also be bringing back the Board of Health policy docket for review, so if you want another chance to look at it and listen in on CHAB conversation, that'll be happening this month as well. Or I'm sorry, in February.
Sean, I had a question about the docket items. There are a couple of items on that docket that are sort of non-negotiable and that the board, they're aligning with the board docket items like the sanitary code updates. How did you handle those with CHAB?
We shared that these are work plan items. These are items the department is prioritizing, you know, and it's still important though to have that community voice and that we can shape those items with CHAB input.
One quick announcement. Whippy Health has announced that we now have a masking mandate for everybody in the hospital. We do provide the masks. They're available on the counters when you come in. And I do not know how long this will last, but I see it as a good thing. And I'm pretty positive about it. So, you know, I think it's a very good idea, as somebody back there already agrees. And I wish I could see more of it. My wife and I try and do it every time we go to the grocery stores. I wish more people would. So,
yeah. I wore my mask on the airplane last week because I didn't want to be sick this week and bring back something for all of you to share with me.
So is this being driven by prime? I just want to make sure I'm letting people know why they need to go get their flu vaccine. Is this being driven by all the people out there with flu, or is it concern about the measles, or is there any particular anything?
Primarily it was concerned about the flu, but we do have a measles problem too. So that doesn't hurt to cover it for that also. Mm-hmm. But there has been an increased number of flu cases in the island, and we're concerned about it. So,
yeah.
It's not too late to get the flu shot. Still can get it. But the rise in acute respiratory illness and hospitalization, we're seeing that information. So thank you.
Evelyn, do you have anything to
add? I just really appreciate the communications on the flu and the measles. I'm your subject matter expert, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
With that, I want to thank you. It was quite a full agenda. My brain is full, but it was good work. So I know it takes a lot for you guys to prepare all of this. So thank you for your work. Thank you for being here. Thank you to Dr. Librand, who is always here. Really appreciate that. And it looks like Eric Marshall may have come in Fort Oak Harbor. Commissioner Marshall, or Councilmember Marshall, I apologize. We didn't see you till just now. But thank you for being here.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Okay, great. All right. I think with that, if nothing more, we are adjourned until the 17th of February.